Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish your outdoor wood projects with Cabot Premium Wood Care Products. Australian Timber Oil is an exterior stain that provides maximum penetration, durability, and water repellency, making it ideal for decks, siding, outdoor furniture, and more. Save big money at Menards on Cabot Premium Wood Care Products. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host, Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band, Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
So, Adam, there's this new movie called Freaky Tales.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes place in Oakland in 1987.
Yeah. I went and saw it just the other day at the... If you live in the Bay Area, I gotta say the best place to see it is the Grand Lake Theater. Just trust me on that.
You live in Alameda, formerly Oakland, so you always get a little excited when Oakland is the backdrop for a film, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I definitely liked the Boots Riley movie that came out a while ago. I like seeing Oakland locations in a film. Ooh, they filmed part of The Matrix here.
Ooh.
but yeah, I specifically, really enjoyed this movie because I feel like they really kind of captured the flavor of what being in the East Bay is like.
Yeah, so the film is, it has some different stories, and then the stories intersect. But the very first story they tell is important to us here on the show.
Yeah.
Because it is called The Gilman Strikes Back. And it is pulled from actual Gilman history. At least the basis of the story is.
And they even have actors playing Operation Ivy in this movie.
They do, I know. The incident that actually took place at 924 Gilman in the late 80s was at an MDC show. So Gilman had been dealing with Nazis coming to shows and causing problems, and then they decided to fight back. The story is a window into the larger national problem of Nazis in the punk and ska scenes in the 80s. So today, we're going to talk to three Gilman folks about the actual event that this film was based off of. So that's Kamala Lynn Parks, George Hated, and NDC singer Dave Dichter. But we're also going to talk to Corbett Redford, who is the director of the excellent documentary Turn It Around, The Story of East Bay Punk, because he covers this incident in his film. And he also helped out the folks of Freaky Tales with some historical accuracy.
Yeah, but first, we're going to talk to Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, the writers and directors of Freaky Tales, to get a sense of how and why they chose to fictionalize this piece of 80s punk lore.
I'm Ryan Fleck, and I'm the writer, director, and one of the producers on Freaky Tales.
And I'm Anna Boden, and I am the other writer, director, and one of the other producers on Freaky Tales.
So first question I want to ask is that, so this film is set in Oakland in the late 80s. Now, Ryan, I believe this is the location and era you grew up in, correct?
Yeah. I grew up I was born in Berkeley. I grew up in Oakland and sort of the East Bay, other areas of the East Bay.
Was there anything that you felt was particularly compelling about this era in terms of being a backdrop for a story and sort of a collage of cultures coming together?
Sure. But I think for me, just personally, being a 10-year-old boy is such like a, you know, and everything when you're hearing things for the first time, experiencing things for the first time, I think just certain things stay with you. And I think that is the visceral sort of connection to the thoughts, the memories, the some invented, some real, who knows, you know, the blur between all of that. And so hearing that Sleepy Floyd game on the radio, knowing about this place called Gilman, the punk scene, being, you know, I was a shy kid, so I didn't go there, you know, but I knew about it and learned about it later in life, became a big fan of that scene later in life. Was also a hip hop fan and a movie fan, right? So just like working all of those things into it, was sort of what made it all important to me as that kid and now as an adult and those bringing those memories to life.
I want to talk about the first chapter, obviously, The Gilman Strikes Back. Can you tell us a little bit about where this idea came from and why it fit within the overall narrative of the film?
Yeah, I'll jump into that one as well. I did go to the Gilman, like I said, so I was aware of its sort of presence. You know, you drive by and see people hanging out as a kid, and I'm like, oh, what goes on in there? And I started to investigate, and then I started to hear stories, and I bought that Gilman book, what's it called? The one that was like self-published that came out. Why am I blanking on it? You guys must know it. The Story So Far, I think is what it's called.
Oh, okay.
And there were some stories in there, and that led me to Corbett, you know, just digging online, that led me to Corbett's movie, Turn It Around, right? The story of East Bay Punk. And he has that great section in there on the Gilman kids fighting the neo-Nazi boneheads, right? And so I was just like, this is it. I've heard these stories over the years, and now the way that he used the animation in that just made it so fun, and I thought, This is one of the stories in this movie. This is going to be perfect. So even before I knew about that, it was like, you know, I heard about Green Day coming out of that movement. And I was like, I knew Too Short was going to be a part of this. This movie was going to be the confluence of all of these things that feel like very different. Too Short and punk rock, you know, Sleepy Floyd, The Warriors, and, you know, old crime movies. You know, how do all these things converge on each other was going to be what made it so fun, I think.
And for us, I think that, you know, what kind of did end up bringing them all together was this theme of like all these East Bay underdogs and, you know, the idea of all these underdogs who are kind of seeking out justice in their own way and, you know, decide to, you know, and for the Gilman story, that being, you know, this kind of really what kind of got our excitement and enthusiasm was these skinny, nonviolent punk kids who literally built a club, like organized their own club based on kind of the ethics of like nonviolence and, you know, non-racism and non-sexism and all those things. But decided like, well, when is it time to fight back? When is it time to like, you know, rise up and fight against the bully? And so, and in a way, like all of our stories and all of our characters are these underdogs, and they all do kind of have their chance to like rise to the bullies. And the fun of our movie is that in our fantasy world, we get to see what it looks like when the underdogs win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a real story, as we've established. It was documented in Turn It Around and in books and stuff. How did you go about fictionalizing it? Were there certain elements that you felt like needed to stay the same and certain elements that you needed to change?
Well, I think we knew that it was leading. We knew what it was leading towards. And based on what we also knew the ending of the movie, The Legend of Sleepy Floyd. We kind of had a sense of what that was going to look like. And so in order to bookend the movie and like let the audience know, hey, this is going to be one of those movies where shit goes off in a big way, that we needed to exaggerate the violence in that at that opening fight. And obviously it didn't, no, you know, they didn't light anybody on fire. I don't think they weren't cutting anyone in the neck, you know. But I just think that in terms of lending itself to the cinematic quality, the cinematic sort of over the top nature of the movie, it was going to be necessary to really exaggerate the fight in that way.
And part of the fun of it is like getting to set this film that feels very like authentically Oakland and like in this very authentic time and place and culture. And particularly when you first jump into it with these, you know, punk kids and they're just like a very specific subculture of this very specific time and place and like making that feel really real, getting all of the details right, all of like the real bands, being able to license the real art and the real music. And, you know, our production designer, Patty Podesta, did the research so that she made the walls of Gilman look exactly like they looked in 1987 and all of that, so that you can have that like reality. And then when things start to lift up from there into more of a fantasy cinematic kind of crazy world, it's exciting and fun and unexpected. And I think that's what we wanted, is like you kind of start in this reality and then it just explodes.
Mm. Yeah. I was going to say it was really fun during the, you know, that whole segment for the aspect ratio of the screen to be shrunk and then have the graphics from the fight scene break that bounding box and then eventually have the whole screen open up. That was really a nice touch.
That was fun. And it was always written so that, you know, it was going to feel like a 16 millimeter, kind of that 80s, you know, decline of Western civilization vibe, in the smaller aspect ratio, grainy film look. And then when the fight happens, things sort of explode out of it. And we always wanted it to feel bigger. And we're no longer in that contained by the rules of like the documentary anymore. We have characters bleeding blood out of the frame. You know, we have the text on the screen, like the old Batman TV show style, with like the boom and the bang and all that stuff. It becomes like another reality.
I have a weird quick question just for myself. Gulch is the hardcore band that's playing the Black Flag cover in the movie. Did you make the singer grow his hair out so that he wouldn't look like one of the skinheads?
Oh, that's so funny. No, I didn't.
I just, every time I've seen him, he has a shaved head.
That's amazing. No, he came to us through an actor we've worked with before. Keir Gilchrist is like, knows, he's in a hardcore band himself, and he knows a lot about this stuff. And we were asking him for like, you know, to introduce us to bands who could be in the movie, and like one of the, who might be from the Bay Area. And like, he suggested Gulch. And when we met him, that's how he looked. So we didn't know, but I did see I saw a video of him performing bald, and I realized, oh yeah, but I don't know if he grew it out for the movie or not.
The choice for Op Ivy to play Bad Town, any thoughts behind that?
I just love the song, and it felt like it was the vibe that we wanted for that scene. It was more vibe oriented than any sort of meaning in the song. But I do remember Tim telling us stories about playing that song. And in terms of like what was going on, playing it in a heightened situation where there were neo-Nazis at a show once, and that's kind of what the song's about. But you guys probably know better than I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely accurate. Also, the song Unity is about dealing with Nazi skinheads too. Stop this! So Gilman, so you guys created Gilman, right? This was not shot at Gilman.
Yeah, I think that we spoke to some of the folks who are still involved with Gilman, and they like toured us around Gilman, but they were also like, it'll be a can of worms to try to shoot here. Don't even try it.
Yeah.
So we just recreated it at a location that we would be able to like control and have more access over and all that.
So to what you were saying earlier, to create Gilman, did you guys go back to footage and photos of Gilman from that era versus like Gilman as it exists now?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. Patty Podesta and our whole art department team just had pictures and pictures, and it was great. And Corbett was super helpful in all of that too. So yeah, it was a recreation. And, you know, we couldn't shoot also at the real Gilman because, you know, Gilman's a pretty busy street out front, and we needed to stage a big fight out in front. So we were in Oakland over by Laney College.
Has that set since been torn down, or is it still there?
Oh yeah, it was just a warehouse.
You want to put a show on there?
Now there are two Gilmans.
Yeah. Tim Armstrong, he has a really quick cameo in the film. What was that process like? So you connected with Tim, and did you say you got a guy? Did he want to be in the film, or did you say like you should be in the film?
Yeah, we said yeah, you should be in the film. We'd love to have you as a cameo in the film, and he was totally into it. And then we gave him a couple options, and he chose actual client of Cytopics. We gave him another option. He was like, nah, that's not me. But he was great. I love that he's actual client, because he is, you know, I would totally believe that he is like tapped into Cytopics.
Aside from like giving you permission to use Op Ivy, you know, the band in the film, did he provide much in the way of like feedback for the film and for the scene itself?
He was super helpful, and he did come to an early cut, and he didn't really have any feedback to say other than he wanted to see the saxophonist on the stage. We had this oneer, the shot that comes in and like goes from outside and up on the stage and introduces the venue, and the saxophone player was not visible. And so we couldn't interrupt that shot, right? But then we found in the edit, we found a shot later on that we could cut when we cut back inside. You see the saxophone player, and that's the only note.
Yeah, I mean, you picked the one. You picked the one Op Ivy song with sax. You better show the sax player.
That's right.
Yeah, he just saw it last night. He was just at a screening last night and saw the final cut of the film for the first time, and was very complimentary. It was great.
Yeah, what's interesting about I remember learning about this story years ago, and there was this whole thing like when, you know, in like 2016 or 2015, when Trump was coming up and Richard Spencer was like this, you know, vocal like white supremacist, and he got like punched in the face online and people were sharing it. And then there was this whole like debate amongst liberals about like, oh, is it okay to punch Nazis? You know, is that stooping to their level? And what I thought was interesting and kind of funny about that conversation was that the punk scene has been dealing with this topic for decades. Like, this is not a new topic for people that were in punk, right? Because you go back to this the 80s, and there's all these Nazi skinheads that are sort of like creeping in on this punk scene, so they're having to like contend with the very same thing. And you talked about it at the front, like this is a place where it's built on anti-violence and anti-racism, but how do they deal with when Nazis are saying, no, we want to be part of that scene? So
yeah,
Not really a question so much as it's just an interesting thing to see how this is not, you know, like this history, this punk history really shows how this is not a new topic. This is an old conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just happens to be, unfortunately more relevant than ever. Mm-hmm. We didn't think that when we were making it, it was going to be like a question again in like 2025, when and Tyson Barbie are outside the Grand Lake and the Nazis are coming. It's like, you know, it's 1987. You'd think that people would know by now that it's not cool to be a Nazi anymore, you know, basically. But it's like, you know, that we're still having the same conversation, but it is like more relevant than ever, that question of like, what, you know, how far do you need to go? Like, when is it time to like stand up and fight against hate? And what does that mean? And what does that look like?
So I drove past the Grand Lake when you guys were filming this, and I saw the marquee with Lost Boys on it. Did anybody actually try to come see Lost Boys?
That's a good question.
I think that there was, I do have this like vague memory of somebody being confused about it, but I don't know if they were trying to see like Creepshow or Ishtar.
Ishtar. People clamoring to see Ishtar.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Corbett Redford. I am the director of the documentary Turn It Around, The Story of East Bay Punk. And I also served as a technical advisor on Freaky Tales.
Corbett, I'm curious how and when you first heard about this film, Freaky Tales.
I believe it was toward the end of, I believe October 2022. I got a text from a friend, Heather McLean, who is a location manager on so many Bay Area television shows and movies. And she had worked as a producer on my band's absurd Life is Excellent music video.
Life is excellent. The tap water tastes like excrement. The skies rain poison. I gotta pay the rent.
And she said, hey, Corbett, you know, these directors, you know, they've mostly done indies, but they did this Captain Marvel movie. They need to talk with you. And I had just moved to the woods and I was like, what is this? This is so odd, you know? And, she didn't really say much about it, but then there was a Zoom meeting and the directors mentioned, that they had a script where, one of the four stories in the film, referenced Gilman. And so they wondered if I would take a look at the script, and I did. And I was so many emotions reading it because, one of the four stories in their movie, the anthology, was around the 1987, Gilman, punks versus skinheads battle. And mostly like public recountances of this history in like Give Me Something Better and many other places were just always saying like the Gilman kids got their asses kicked. All they got, you know, and this, when we found out, from a lot of the people we interviewed for the Turn It Around documentary, that there was indeed this time that the kids stood up, the punks of Gilman stood up against the Nazis and defeated them, and they never came back and harassed the club. That felt like important history. And that was what the focus of that anthology story was in Freaky Tales. Mind you, it is, you know, an alternate reality kind of, you know, larger than life, urban legend retelling of that battle. But I kept, as soon as I saw it, I thought to myself, I think our society and our country really needs more movies to remind us that Nazis are a common enemy. And so I thought, I could lend a hand with this. So myself and the people who this history is important to could watch this and be more enthusiastic and see Easter eggs. And so I work with Elena Nominson on set design. And, you know, I think they originally had photos from the 2010s of Gilman. And, you know, however much I like Jake Useless's tags all over the club during that era, in 1987, there wasn't as much graffiti. There were certain items like the Meese is a pig poster that was on the back wall. Ed Meese, right? The big, what was he doing? Censorship and everything. And so I helped Elena find that in the Smithsonian Digital Archives. They printed that up, you know, certain work with set design, with props. I got them to get, big wheels to drive through the crowd, you know, and then costuming. It turns out Margaret Cleaver, who I met through Geek Fest and Gilman, the Gilman punk scene, was on the costume team. And I remember getting this text because we were in a production thread together. And she's like, Corbett, oh my God, you're here. Please help me. I need Come All on the Carnivores, Bitch Fight, Yeasty Girls. I need these logos to make the costumes accurate, you know? And I find it to be one of the greatest achievements of my life that I approached pretty much every elder Gilman feminist and said, and with the only knowledge at that point of the production was that Too Short was an executive producer. And somehow I convinced them to use their logos on the shirts of the costume, the punks of the scene. So that's a long-winded telling of it, but around October 22nd. And then I kind of got whisked into everything, and then later music licensing and all sorts of other stuff.
And then you appeared in the film briefly.
I did. And, you know, like the directors with Captain Marvel, there's this moment where the main character walks past one of the original authors of Captain Marvel comics, you know? And so, you know, they were like, well, we want to give you a featured kind of cameo. So like, I kind of walk in, you know, and I thought it would be a great idea before I had this beard at the time to shave it down to a mustache because of 1980s or something. Such a bad decision. And now it's on the celluloid forever. I have to live with that choice. But yeah, so yeah, I'm right in the beginning of the movie and then right toward the end of the movie with this horrible mustache. So maybe it was a nod kind of to the history and the kind of,
sure. I think so.
I'm also curious. I mean, you kind of went into some details, but I'm also curious any insight you had regarding choices that they made, you know, in relation to honoring the history versus kind of like allowing it to be fictionalized.
That's a good question. So I did give script notes to the directors. I worked with the set design and costume and props teams very diligently, even the music licensing teams. But, you know, I wanted to go through, I was able to go through the script and give notes. And there were certain things where, you know, there's a moment where these two characters who were obviously, you know, two of the heads of the club are celebrating and kind of clinking beers. I didn't think that would have happened, but you want to give grace to the fictional kind of story, you know, clinking beers after the skinheads are defeated, you know. There was one sticking point, which, you know, without trying to sound like a gatekeeper, you know, in the original script, all of the kids kept referring to it as the Gilman. Yeah. And the Gilmanite in me just, I kept, my grandfather calls it the Gilman, you know, like just Gilman, you know? And so they got the script note. They wound up changing it in the script. And when, we met with Kamala Parks and Michelle Gonzalez and Jeff Armstrong, and the directors were, you know, so grateful to meet with them, you know, saying that they wanted to honor the Gilman. Suddenly there was this roundhouse of Gilman elders saying, Gilman, you know, and they were like, yeah, like he told us that, you know, we're really trying to change it in our vernacular. But then Ryan Fleck told me, he said, Anna and I have been talking and we really want to keep chapter one calling it Strength in Numbers, aka The Gilman Strikes Back, because of a reference to The Empire Strikes Back. And he said, what if we had these two little animated Gilman punks come out? And so after Too Short announces the name of the chapter, the Gilman punks come out and cross out the word "the." And I said, that's perfect. Because, for any kind of punk purist who's out there and is suddenly bemoaning the movie, oh, here we go, that's a little instant nod to, like, relax, you know, and just have fun with this, you know.
We were hoping you could explain how you chose to portray the fight scene in Turn It Around versus this movie.
With the knowledge that historically, you know, and all the historic retellings of Gilman in that era, that the Gilman kids would always just get their asses handed to them by the skinheads, I thought it was important to have that debate, because that was an internal debate. We are a no violence club, you know, we're choosing violence, you know, and it's interesting to hear, because, you know, in this time, you know, currently where, you know, sometimes the only way you can greet fascists or you can greet Nazis is to respond with their language, right? Sadly. And I believe that the film, the kind of depiction of that, they have the same debate, right?
Uh-huh.
There was those warring factions, right? Anybody who's been to a Gilman meeting knows, you know, it's always a vote, and there are multiple different sides. So I don't think it was too far from how we depicted it in our documentary. At least that part, you know, so much more of it was so over the top, you know, and which I think is cathartic, you know, watching mm-hmm. these kids get these superpowers during this, you know, there's this underdog energy going through the East Bay that night, and they just completely demolish these Nazis, you know, who many of them were Burt Rahman folks, Sharps and Buddhists. And when I got to the set, I was like, Scotty, you know, Brandon, like under 15 seconds. And like, you know, all these locals, you know, they were portraying them. And it made me feel really happy. There were so many Gilman folks. Eli Corral from so many local bands was in special effects. And I didn't, when I got to the set and saw the production, there were so many Gilman folks there. But I don't know if I answered your question. I'm sorry. you know, the documentary, it was important for us to portray that there was a deliberation about choosing violence inside the Gilman kind of meetings, you know, and that it was a unifying moment for the club at that time, where I think we say in the club, you know, or Iggy Pop narrates at that point in the documentary, that Gilman was a thing and it was a working thing, and there were shows every night, and there were lots of things happening and decisions being made. But sometimes home doesn't become home until you're forced to defend it, you know? And I think that jubilation that we show in the victory in the battle in the film was also mirrored in this kind of fictional depiction. You know, I do want to share something, and I mentioned this to the directors. Scott from this Gilman band called the Skin Flutes, this old school band, shared with us something about the battle that was not included in our cut or in the other cut, in the fictional version of it. But I guess during this melee, when the red pickup truck shows up, which I was there on set when they filmed that, and it was moving. It was very disturbing. Like, you know, but down the street from the battle at Ashkenaz, there were these two nearly 7 foot tall black capoeira dancers with boken swords who were leaving a class at Ashkenaz, who happened to wander into the melee. So suddenly these superhero dudes show up and join the punks with these boken staves doing capoeira art and kicking Nazi butt too. So that was something I thought that was so larger than life that I was sad we didn't include it in our edit. And I talked to Ryan and Anna. I was like, maybe you could add it. They didn't add it as well, but yeah, truth is often stranger than fiction.
Yeah, who's going to believe that?
Yeah, right? Who's going to believe that? Yeah, yeah, so.
The other thing about your portrayal I thought was interesting and I thought made their version of it similar to yours was that you animated the fight. And by animating it, you kind of also made it a little bit larger than life.
Yeah, perhaps that's why it stood out for them, you know, as that it could be this kind of, you know, over the top retelling of the battle, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what Tim Armstrong talks about, there was this decision, you know, and let's put some bats up in the sound booth, you know, or in the, you know, the Gilman loft, you know, there were, some folks that built things and brought things to the battle, but in the movie, it's like so elaborate, you know, Mikey Infante, who, I can't remember the name of his character in it, but he's on the crutches and during the montage in the movie, there's suddenly this ejected blade, you know, that comes out of his crutches, you know. I mean, during the premiere the other evening, those were the points, because we had a few rows of kind of Gilman elders and Gilman folks. Those are the points that I found the biggest cheers from the, you know, the purists and the founders of Gilman because it becomes an urban legend, you know, it becomes this kind of wild, fantastical retelling of it. But the truth, I think, is still just as strong, you know, and it just as moving. Yeah, you know, Grandpa wasn't always lying, right, when he was telling those stories, you know.
Mm-hmm. So part of the story of the real incident was that the Nazis stopped coming to Gilman after the fight, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, so Kamala Parks tells it, and it's such a great line. I think when we were, you know, screening the documentary in theaters, when she said, and they destroyed that red pickup truck, and some of the Nazis got into it. George Hated talks about it, and some of them ran off. And then Kamala Parks so eloquently says, and they went fuck all back to Concord, and we never saw them again. And that elicited, you know, a lot of... a lot of laughs, because, you know, anyone from around here knows that kind of region, over there, like, in far west Contra Costa County, I guess, there has been, you know, decades and decades of, you know, Nazis and skinheads over there. It's hard to play shows over there because of it. But yeah, so they, from what everyone had told me, during those interviews, historically, they didn't come back and shut down shows anymore. They learned their lesson, and the Gilman kids could kind of create freely. And actually, I think at that point, that's when you have this next wave of Gilman that starts to happen. Like, that's even more kind of wild, like Blatts and Filth and these kind of, you know, androgynous and trans melees where people are throwing, you know, confetti and cottage cheese out into the audience, and everyone's naked. And, you know, that I think potentially that kind of doubling down and that protecting of that, of their space might have encouraged a bit more artistic freedom there.
Well, so one thing, I was rewatching the scene in your documentary, and one comment that Iggy Pop made was that this problem, this Nazi skinhead problem was a problem all over the country. However, he said that it was particularly a problem in the Bay Area.
I think that, yeah, that was Dave Dichter and Jello Biafra mentioned that. And from what I can tell, from everyone we talked to, one of the reasons that San Francisco scene, you know, the birthplace of punk in the Bay Area at the Def Club and the Mabuhay Gardens, one of the reason why a lot of those kind of more artful bands, Mutants and Nuns and the Avengers and DK were like more rock and punk, right? But the advent of hardcore and this kind of more aggressive style of music became a good soundtrack for these Nazis to show up and kind of kick everyone's butt. So notoriously at places like The Farm, and on Broadway and the MAB even, they would show up and they would destroy the show. And that actually made the need for Gilman even arise, you know, like as a safe space with no violence, and suddenly punk had rules, right? So it was extremely bad in San Francisco, so much that a lot of bands that were from there wouldn't play there anymore, you know, or they even dissolved, you know, during that rise. So, yeah, so Gilman, you know, I think maybe the first 6 months or something, it wasn't affected by that. But also during that time, they weren't really advertising shows. That was one of their earlier things, was that if you're going to show up, you're going to show up because you want to be part of things, not because of, you know, some big name band or something, you know. But I think when maybe they started promoting, the Skinheads got an awareness around it, and then they aimed at Gilman.
Do you have any insight into why San Francisco was such a target? Was there more Nazis there, or was it because they were so contrary to what the Nazis were about that they wanted to destroy it?
I think, well, like the Vats and the Farm, and I hear stories of this person named Mark Dagger. You know, Jello and I think a few other people really emphasized that there was a national skinhead movement at that point. I can't remember the name of the guy who ran it, but that wasn't really that wasn't really what was going on. It wasn't part of a national movement that was causing that in San Francisco. I think things were getting lawless, you know, like Feinstein had a, she was the mayor, and her husband was like a developer, and he wanted to see a lot of these Broadway clubs get shut down. So people would even tell us that when, like, Kevin Collins, you know, the kid who was kidnapped and on the milk cartons, you know, that there started to be this buzz that punks were around him when it happened, right? They were trying to kind of demonize punks in the culture. And I believe that might have caused things to go further underground. And oftentimes when that happens, there becomes more aggression, there becomes more lawlessness. And,
I see.
Yeah. You know, so, and then, yeah, then you get places like illegal places, like the Vats and the Farm, and it's not about, you know, clubs with permits. It's about these outdoor or truly underground shows where then drugs come into the picture and more violence come into the picture. And oftentimes, you know, hate can bubble there as well.
So is the story a lesson to punch Nazis?
Ooh, whenever I have, it's always been a bad idea, because whenever it causes more, it's just suddenly everything takes that turn, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, when they're causing harm initially, God, there's so many other instances where it's popping up in my head. Do you wait, right? Do you wait for them to cause harm again, you know, or do you stand up? I can't tell anyone that, you know, responding to violence with violence is the way, you know, because I don't want anybody to get harmed, you know, but sometimes it's just absolutely the only thing that you can do, you know, yeah, but you know, don't get hurt. You know, I mean, I remember one time when we did that, when I responded to the violence, suddenly I've got this bevy of friends who are, I got a corkscrew in my leg, and everyone's like, ooh, wounded and leaving this thing, you know? And, you know, it's like, but could have we talked this person away? Probably not. Right. So, it's a hard question to answer.
Case by case.
Yeah. Case by case. It's always a good response to punch a Nazi, but, consider the consequences, you know?
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
My name's George. I was head coordinator and had been at Gilman probably about 6 months, maybe a little bit longer that night.
All right. I'm Dave Dichter. I'm the singer of a band called MDC. And I was there, you know, I moved to the Bay Area. I came in 81 and played with the Dead Kennedys in San Francisco. It was kind of the older scene. And but I'll talk about that more later, the skinhead situation that was going on in the Bay. But I love you people, and I'm an MDC and still am, a band going 47 years.
My name's Kamala, not Kamala Harris, or not Kamala Harris, but Kamala Parks. Throws everyone off, but there we go. And I helped found 924 Gilman. I've been involved off and on since it's been, even before it was open. And I was a somewhat pacifist in terms of our approach to skinheads and what they were doing to our scene, you know, what they were doing.
Well, I want to know what led up, like, what were the incidents happening before you guys fought back?
Well, yeah, I was part of the scene in the Bay Area since 81, 82. And the skinheads were part of the scene. They were part of that street, you know, street kind of scene. A lot of street hustlers. I'm talking about 81, 82, 83. And San Francisco had this whole thing with the SF skins. And, you know, they started off being the scene kind of protectors, but then they wanted a bigger part. And all of a sudden, Bad Nature came out. And, the whole skinhead thing kind of blew up. And there were compounds that were actually trying to recruit, like, white Aryan resistance, war. These groups are actually trying to bring in these people, and they'd have these compounds with, you know, 50 people staying there. And we heard there was one north of Gilman Street, and that's going into 84, 85, 86. And it was getting worse and worse. You know, it's where you, at one part, you know, skinheads were the ska part of the scene, to like all of a sudden, they were just being these ugly, bad guys. And these people we didn't know at all of a sudden were in the Bay Area. And that's what was happening in Gilman Street. They started showing up and harassing people outside.
Can you think of any specific incidents before you fought back, especially something that might have like triggered you guys to say, okay, we can't handle this anymore?
Well, from my perspective, what came in was... that they're like, for weeks before, and maybe even a couple months, we'd hear these rumors that they came to shows, and they were beating people up outside, and they're just kind of like mugging people and that kind of stuff. And we kept hearing this, and then we heard the threats that they were going to come and do something to the shows.
Okay, George, do you want to answer that question?
Sure, kind of. Over the weeks leading up to the MDC show, we were seeing a few Nazis, then a few more, and they, just like everybody else, there were a lot of people that would just kind of come to Gilman, not actually go to the show, just hang around down the street drinking. But as the weeks led up to it, an integral part of it was we knew we were going to have problems the night of MDC, because they were staunchly anti-Nazi. And, well, you know, if you tell people we don't like you, they have a tendency to want to show up to let you know that, well, we don't like you either. So the weeks leading up to it, there were more and more Nazis showing up. We wouldn't let them into the club. That was kind of de rigueur. As long as we knew they were Nazis, they were 86, they couldn't come in, but there were a lot of people with them that we didn't know who they were. If you had a membership card, you got into the show. Just because you were bald doesn't mean you were a Nazi. It just means you were bald. But that night, as more and more of them showed up, we kind of knew we were going to have a problem, and it was just a matter of how to deal with it. And as an ideal pacifist, I didn't think necessarily that violence was the right answer, because violence isn't always the right answer. But sometimes, you know.
I think everyone's covered just the general skinhead incursions in shows that had been going on for years. But I'd say there was one incident in particular that really started getting us down, those of us who have been pacifists, getting down the road of this is just not going to work. And so I believe Op Ivy or someone else was playing actually at the Berkeley Square a couple, like not long before this incident. And it was Lenny from Isocracy at the time and Jake Sales, who was in Filth. Lenny and Jake were in Filth together later on, but at this point Jake wasn't in a band, and there were a number of other people at the show. And it was at the end of the show, and we were coming out, and we saw this woman named Nancy. So she was dating a guy named Screamer, and so Screamer and Nancy they were replicating Sid and Nancy's relationship. So it was a lot of that, you know, Screamer and, you know, Nancy, and I don't know what her real name was. But in any case, they had somehow, as whatever they were trying to do as a replicating the Sex Pistols 1977 punk in 1986, or seven, they had fallen in with the skinheads. And I never quite understood how that happened, but alas, it did. And so we came out, and Nancy had one of the Gilman volunteers, Katja, pinned on not a retaining wall, but when there's plantings and it's like a riser for that people have to plant their things. So they basically, Nancy had Katja pinned down and was spitting in her face. And it was really jarring to come out, obviously, and see that. So I know I was the first one to run up, and I peeled Nancy off, and I was getting ready, like she was obviously ready for a fight. I was getting ready to fight her, and from nowhere, a skinhead girl came from behind her and just totally punched me in the face. And then it became a melee between all these skinheads. Sorry, and I should have mentioned there were a bunch of skinheads all around. And it became a melee. Many of us hadn't. I had been in fights before, but many of the other people I were with hadn't really been in fights, and so it was a very, very jarring incident. And seeing just the extent to which they were targeting Gilman punks, probably because either they couldn't get in or whatnot. And so I think we came away from that really feeling like, wow, they're just targeting us now, even outside of Gilman. So, and I hope, you know, one of the reasons why we knew the skinheads were coming, and I hope someone has already said it, but if not, was because MDC had released a skinhead song about that.
Yeah. What's the song called?
Skinhead.
Hey, hold it 1 minute here. I don't like this song at all. You're trying to put us down. You're trying to call us violent. We're not violent. You want to see violent? You should sing in the night. Bam, bam, bam. Kick, kick, kick. That was violent.
And so the acronym stands for each line. Dave can say it better than I can. Each line, and I still remember this to this day, you know, S because you're stupid, K because you're part of the KKK. So Dave is way better than me, obviously.
I because you're an idiot, and N, you're a Nazi too. H is because we hate you each and every day. A because you're such an asshole. D, disappear and go away. Destroy the USA. We had lots of different lines in there, and we put it out on our one of our albums, and we got that reputation. I'd had a lot of skinheads, you know, want to mix it up with me, and it was just part of, hey man, the truth hurts. You got to say what you got to say. And it's right down to what the Proud Boys today, you know, which is just another form of that, trying to shut it down. And then, and they actually come to music shows. Actually, Proud Boys came to a music show of ours in Tacoma, about five or six of them, tried to start some shit. And the people just right away just wailed on them and pushed them away. And, you know, sometimes it happens and sometimes they get the upper hand. I hate when they go to, like, you know, and, you know, they go against trans peoples because they're a very vulnerable community.
Yeah.
And that's the real world we live in. And, we, you know, we're the band that came up with No Trump, No KKK, No Fascist USA. And it's all part of the continuum. We're trying to push the ball of human being behavior forward, you know, politically, socially, and realistically. And Kamala and I are still at it, and I bet you people are too, trying to push the ball forward socially, community-wise. And it's just really important to have community. Makes me feel good that this moment was recognized. Anyway, I love you people. I love you people, and I'm glad we're celebrating, and kudos to Pedro and all the other weird stories of the Bay Area. And there's a million and one weird stories in the Bay Area. But yeah, that night was, and leading up to it, was tension in the air. And, you know, how to deal with violent people has always been kind of, you know, fighting violence with violence is always kind of the last step. But we could see as that night was coming down that, you know, we had to step up. And you know, if they were going to attack, then we were going to have to respond. And it wasn't going to be like Jesus Christ turning the other cheek. It was going to be more like we're going to stand our ground. And they came. And I remember the night, you know, that they came. They were coming like in waves. There were like five and six of them. And they were coming up on the club. And I remember I was standing there with Orlando and with Fraggle, two other people that were on the crew. And these guys came up and tried to attack us. And I actually took the baseball bat. And something just clicked in with me that it's time to step up, you know. And I'm more pretty, you know, than a fighter, you know, a lover than a fighter. But I just realized it was time to step up. And I was a bit older. I was like 5 years older than everybody. And you know, I had to take that responsibility to try to lead, to protect ourselves at the club. And we pulled it off. You know, a smaller amount of people outside the club drove these people away. I remember at one point I took the baseball bat and I crashed the windshield of a big suburban car. And it shattered, and everyone looked at me, and I said, "Get the heck out of here!" And it was just kind of a beautiful moment. Someone described me as a berserker, and it really was like I was stepping up. I was doing it for the people I love, like Kamala, and like, you know, my band, and all the people that love my band. And over the last 5-7 years in the punk rock scene all around the world, I was getting stuff. The Northern Skins from the UK jumped me on stage in front of the Dead Kennedys. It had been going on for years. Gilman was this protective little kind of like music experiment. It was gigantic, actually. But as far as I was concerned, it was new and fresh. And they had to deal with the things. And, you know, and everyone was realizing, how do you fight people that are, you know, really want to express themselves with violence. And we had to step up and stand tall and in some cases fight them back and break their windshields and yell at them. And happily, it worked out good.
I have a question that maybe we'll give this to George. Was there an actual meeting to prepare for this show, this incident that you expect, that you were planning on fighting back? Was there an actual discussion about it?
No, I mean, there have been discussions in membership meetings in the weeks leading up to it. We met as security that night because we knew there was going to be a problem. But no, there was no plan on specifically how we were going to deal with it.
So was there any prep made? I mean, I know in Turned Around, Tim Armstrong talks about bringing bats and putting them in the sound booth.
I mean, there was always a bat in the sound booth, but in general, no, there was no stashing of weapons. There was no plan. It wasn't terribly cinematic. It was literally just, oh shit, well, what do we do now? Let's handle it. Coming from a military background, I knew that, all right, we work with what we got.
Mm-hmm. George is very, very good about being super resourceful. I will say that. Like, you're a man who will go out into the woods with simply a knife and camp.
Everything you need is right there. You just got to make it happen.
Sleep under the leaves and whatnot. But I'd say that, yeah, the movie, you know, the movie is the movie. It's, and I think it's always a problem when you're taking a real story and you're partially fictionalizing things, and you're doing so for dramatic effect. But yeah, as George said, I wouldn't say, like, all the elements about what they were discussing had been discussed multiple times. You know, what should we do about the skinhead? Should we call the cops? Should we, you know, hire off-duty officers? Those were all elements. But yeah, the whole idea of us spending days creating weapons wasn't really there. And so what I recall from the weapons, quote unquote, that was used, it was what was on hand. So there was a stool, you know, stools that were brought out, and the bats were always there because the skinheads were always there. So that was already there. I, you know, people, punks oftentimes had chains. So you just took the chains off and you used that. But yes, just as George said, it was a melange of potential. I wouldn't be surprised if someone had a pencil and was trying to.
That was how Dave ended up with that aluminum crutch. It was just, all right, we got to make this happen. That's that. He seems to remember that he used a bat. It wasn't a bat. He had an aluminum crutch.
Others, though, had bats and they definitely, you know, hit out the headlights and the windscreen of the trucks or whatever was there.
Without a doubt. Some of the stuff was stuff we took from them. So as things got more tense that night, we had Nando was standing outside by the front door. Motorhead was still at the side door. And I decided to go inside and go to the bathroom because I could tell that it was on really soon. When I came back out the front door, Nando was lying in the gutter right outside the front door. There were three skinheads standing over him, one of them with a bat. So I took the bat out of one of their hands, hit the three of them, got him up, got him back inside, and that was another weapon we had. So you use what you got.
It was very dicey. You know, there was like 30 of them, and there was like about 10 of us standing outside. It was like one of those, gee whiz, you know, gulp real hard. How are we going to do this? We all kind of looked at each other, and yeah, I got to say, you know, their hearts weren't all that into it. I mean, there are some bad personalities, but I'm glad there wasn't 30 people like the way we felt. There was a lot of people that would just stand, you know, not to steal from the moment and how dangerous it was, because it really was, but we were very more motivated to defend our place than they were to try to, like, steal the stage, from my perspective.
Yeah, I think that's what I was going to kind of ask, is, like, you guys were probably, even though you guys were more of the pacifist sort of group and they were more used to, like, using violence as a tactic, you guys maybe felt a stronger sense of, you know, motivation to end this rather than they might have. Yeah,
something clicked in me and my pacifism got left at the door. And when I went outside, it was like, hey, it's us against them. It's 30 against 10. Let's give them a good ride. And you know, and someone described me as a berserker. That's exactly how I was. I just flipped the switch that said, this is the night. This is the night. We're not going to let them take over this club that we all worked hard for. That, you know, Tim Yohannan from Maximum Rock and Roll started this great space for us. And we're not going to let these people shut us down and take it away from us. So time to turn into a superhero and just, you know, take a baseball bat out of someone's hand. And I remember, you know, I kind of forget the crutch, but I remember grabbing a baseball bat like I'm, you know, I wanted to break the windows out of their car. And it was just, it was a great kind of thing. Once, you know, it was like all these people getting hit by baseball bats, it didn't do anything. And then when you broke glass, it was like that dramatic moment where all of a sudden they looked at themselves and they reassessed that moment and they started to fade away.
And I think really what turned the tide that night wasn't any one of us. It was the fact that we kept telling people to go back inside because we were going to handle it. But more and more people came outside. More and more people got involved. It wasn't any one of us that did anything. And if any one of us believes that, that's a mistake. It was the fact that it started out with there were three of us, then there were 10 of us, then there were 30 of us, then there were 60, 70, 80, 100 people outside. And even if they weren't all fighting and all angry, you know, the fact that that weight of numbers suddenly shifted meant that what they had been getting away with for years, which was six of them standing over one kid and that kid like, whatever, here, take my boots, take my jacket. Now, all of a sudden, the odds weren't in their favor anymore.
Yeah.
When bullies realize they can no longer get away with bullying, they run. It wasn't me. It wasn't Nando. Love Dave. It wasn't Dave. It was everybody. It was the fact that people were ready to have had enough.
It was definitely a community effort. And it was amazing how one person stood up, then the original three or five people that were doing security at the club were there. And then, like you said, someone joined in from here, there, and everywhere. And all of a sudden, there was 10 of us. And then all of a sudden, by the end, it was 100 people saying, go away, and then running to their cars and driving away. It was that beautiful moment when the tide is turned and people just say, enough is enough.
And I'd say, that is true that like it seemed like there was a endless supply of punk rockers to come out and take these people on. And also, I think the other thing is that when they started to retreat, rather than us staying on the side of Gilman, we chased them. And I think that really unnerved them to have punk rockers actually being the aggressor in this instance, because previously, you know, it's not like, oh, we would just take it all the time. You know, there was fighting back, but it was never this sense of unity because a lot of us were squeamish and didn't know. I think, you know, we didn't know, like, if we did this, would they come back for more or would they go somewhere else or whatever it was? There was never a sense of this is definitive. And I think that's the other thing is that we did this thing, but it's not like you came back and were euphoric. You're like, shit, are they going to come back with?
We assume they'd be back next weekend.
Yeah. Like, or are they going to come back with even more like, and get their retribution? And I think it was oddly eerily quiet for many weeks. And it's kind of, I think we were all surprised at the efficacy of this, and I'm not sure it would have been the solution before or after, but at that moment, having this well of resistance that they hadn't experienced before, and somehow about the timing, it really broke their spirit that we didn't anticipate. But I think one of the things, had we just stood our ground and not chase them, I feel like they might have come back later. But having us chase them, and I say us, even though I kind of walked into the melee and wasn't ultimately part of the melee. I was just kind of like, I'd gone up the street to buy gum or something. And then I come back down and I come into this like, oh my God, what's happening? So I was more of a witness to seeing it from as I'm approaching the crowd and watching these punks just
chase the skinheads, and it was a beautiful moment, but I would not say that I felt like, oh, this is definitive.
No, we got lucky. One of the things that we on security knew, and specifically I knew, two of the people that were there, Billy and a guy named Bart, who was from, I guess he lived out in Tracy and was really well involved with a church called the Church of the Creator. They're a Christian white identity movement. Bart had a gun. Billy had a gun. So we got very, very lucky that things didn't get even further out of hand than they did. The fact that nobody, as far as I know, got stabbed that night. As far as I know, obviously, nobody got shot. Oh, no. It was an amazing, amazing thing, but it literally just kind of turned on a dime because it could have just as easily gone horrible. So, no, we got lucky, but when it works, it works.
Now, they didn't come back to Gilman. What was your take on their overall presence in the Bay Area scene, the punk scene?
Oh, they were still around. They still showed up to shows.
They kind of left you guys alone, though, but they still were kind of being a problem elsewhere.
Yeah, that never changed.
But I'd say it diminished a lot.
I feel like before that event, they were ubiquitous. And I felt like they were cut off at the knees a little bit. And I actually don't remember them. I just don't have a memory of them being the ubiquitous presence that they were. If I saw them, I hardly noticed them.
Yeah, by the time Aaron and I started going to shows, it was just like the specter of it. Like, I remember a show at a teen center in San Jose. Suddenly there were five skinheads Sig Heiling in the pit. And when you blinked, they had already ran out the door and left. Like, nobody even had to deal with them. They dealt with themselves.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, in the 90s, it didn't feel like the same kind of problem in the scene that it did in the 80s.
No, I mean, and part of it is that whole scene had started to change by the 90s. We went up to Portland when Tom Metzger was on trial back in 89, 90. And one of the things that he told all of them, or at least that he broadcast all of them, was grow out your hair, become doctors, become lawyers, become police officers. Keep your values, but blend in, because we will be more effective as a movement if we blend in. So a lot of them, they grew their hair out. They stopped going to shows, but they didn't change. They just blended. The entire scene changed. I mean, skinheads in the scene were ubiquitous in 85, still in 89. By 93, 94, there were less shows that specifically attracted them. And there were less of them.
That's true. I'm glad you remembered that, George. Yeah, I mean, definitely when you'd get outside the Bay Area, like if you went up to Davis and Sacramento, you still had big problems up there for a long time.
Sacramento was rough.
I remember part of them saying they were giving up on cities that had a large minority populations. So they started going to places like Portland and Las Vegas, and Boise, Idaho, and the northern Idaho, Moscow, Idaho. That was part of their deal to try to do something in the Bay Area. A lot of people just who have nothing to do with punk rock are going to be anti the racist. Where, you know, when you're in a place like Boise, Idaho, It's weirder when you're in a community of 95% white people with a little gay population and all the rest, you know. So that was part of it. They made that structural move to, you know, like George says, blend in, but also to be in cities where they could get away with it better.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow @In Defense of Ska on social media.
The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying Ska now more than ever. Aaron?
Yes.
Do you get your popcorn with butter or without?
Yeah, butter. I'm going to go with butter.
Okay. I usually do without butter. But you know what I can't do without?
What?
The In Defense of Ska Patreon.
Yeah, I can't do without it either. I need it.
You should defend Ska the way that these kids defended Gilman from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
By signing up for our Patreon.
Yes.
It's only $5. You'll be supporting this show. But yeah, I think that would be a nice thing for you to do. That would be a nice way for you to cap off this episode.
It would be.
Hey, folks, once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like, that's the member I'd really like, because he was the one that started the band. He was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band up until the point he quit, which was partial way through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy, you know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefenseofska. Ska now more than ever.
Now at Menards, save big on everything for your landscaping project. Whether you're shopping for edgers, pavers, or wall blocks, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Plus, get fast free estimates when you use our landscape design program, available in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on landscape blocks when you shop at Menards. Also, check out the great deals from our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.